Good evening, and welcome to a one-night stand with the big bands. You're listening to the theme song, which evokes more feeling than perhaps any other. Moonlight Serenade, the theme for the Glenn Miller Orchestra. This is Arnold Dean, and tonight on a one-night stand, our guest is the celebrated big band authority, George T. Simon, the man Glenn Miller wanted to write his biography. And now he has. We'll discuss Glenn Miller and listen to some of his great music on a one-night stand with the big bands, brought to you by WTIC and by Russo Chevrolet, across from the Bradley Air Museum in Windsor Locks, where both sales and service are outstanding. We'll begin the Glenn Miller story at the very beginning, but musically, let's start with the final band he was to lead, the one many describe as the greatest big band of them all, the Glenn Miller AAF Band, featuring the likes of Peanuts Hucko on clarinet, Bobby Nichols on trumpet, and Lou Stein on piano. This is Flyin' Home. Glenn Miller and the AAF Band, Flyin' Home. There's no better time to appreciate the beauty of the great outdoors than the summertime. And there's no better way to see the beautiful country than behind the wheel of a 1974 Chevy Blazer, featured now at Russo Chevrolet in Windsor Locks. The Blazer is one of the newest models in Chevy's lineup. It was designed for toughness, built as if there were no roads at all. Featured on every Chevy Blazer are a frame made of high-strength carbon steel, a reinforced hood, double-wall front fenders, and an energy-absorbing steering column. A new power brake system matching stopping power to total vehicle weight has been incorporated into each and every Blazer. Options on the Blazer include a comfort tilt steering wheel, air conditioning, and an AM or AM/FM radio. See and test drive a new Chevy Blazer at Russo Chevrolet in Windsor Locks. Take the Bradley exit from I-91, then the first exit to Russo Chevrolet, directly across from the Bradley Air Museum, just a short drive from Hartford. When it comes to Chevrolet, the people at Russo are experts. And now let's meet our frequent guest and good friend, author, composer, musician, George T. Simon. It seems we always begin by saying George has just finished writing another book. I've never looked forward to one more than this one, though. Glenn Miller and his orchestra. And George, I think it could be your best yet.
Well, thanks very much, Arnold. It took quite a while to get it done because I'd never done a biography before, and it was quite an adventure for me. Interestingly enough, I thought I knew Glenn before I'd written the book. I thought I knew him really well, but then after I'd interviewed about 50 people who were close to him and added their impressions of Glenn, their remembrances of Glenn to what I had remembered, my impressions of him, he changed quite a bit. He was a much more complex man than I ever had realized.
Isn't it something when you find out a little about a subject, you find there's an awful lot more to find out about that subject? I thought I knew a little about Glenn Miller, but believe me, your book has been an education, but an immensely readable education. There's so much to talk about, but before we do anything, to take it in order, the contents lists part one, the early years, and that's where I began to learn things about Glenn. Could you basically tell us about his upbringing, where he was born and when?
Well, he was born in Clarinda, Iowa, and came from a very poor family out in the Midwest. He was brought up in various places, and then they moved to Nebraska after that, and they moved to Colorado after that. His father had difficulty making ends meet, and for a while they lived in a sod hut even. And Glenn was actually brought up much more by his mother, who was a very strong person, also a very strict person. And her feelings about people were strictly the pioneer Midwestern approach. You've got to do it on your own. You've got to be strong. You cannot show emotions. And that type of attitude, which was very prevalent 50 years ago, 60 years ago in the Midwest, and maybe now for all I know among certain people.
Was he an enterprising youngster? Did he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he tried to do all sorts of things. I know he had a fish net, and he milked cows, and he worked in a sugar mill, I think it was, a sugar factory or something. He worked whenever he could, but he was interested, of course, in music from the very beginning, and he fell in love with a trombone. His older brother played trumpet in the town band, and Glenn finally hung around enough, and then the leader of the band let him use a trombone. When he found that Glenn loved it so much, he gave him the trombone. That's how it all started.
Isn't that amazing? Someone in the book is quoted as saying that he was never more than a pedestrian trombonist.
Benny Goodman was the one who said that he was a pedestrian trombone player. And, of course, Benny knew him very well. They were roommates together, you know. There's an interesting thing I found out, for example, in the book, when I did the book, and that is that when Glenn went out to California from Colorado, he moved in with a friend of his, another musician from Colorado, who was a sax player in Ben Pollock's band. Now, the Pollock band was going to go back to Chicago. This sax player was in love with a girl out on the West Coast and didn't want to leave, so he was going to stay out there. And there was also a trombone player in the band who didn't want to leave. So the sax player said, why don't we have Glenn audition? He told Ben Pollock and Gil Roden, who was with the Pollock at the time, and said, listen to this fellow, Glenn Miller. So they listened to Glenn. Now, what happened is that the sax player left. He was replaced by, of all people, by Benny Goodman. And you know who the sax player was?
I have no idea.
Ted Mack.
Oh, my gosh.
The original amateur hour. Isn't that wild?
Was he a good saxophonist?
He was a good saxophonist. His name was Ted McGinnis in those days.
My gosh.
And he was a saxophonist in Ben Pollock's band, whom Benny Goodman replaced.
That's an amazing story, George. I'd like to play some early Glenn Miller, not with the Pollock band, but with Red Nichols and his Five Pennies. Actually, I learned later in your book that Red Nichols and Glenn Miller didn't get along all that famously, and Glenn always wondered how many pennies were actually used, although the band was billed as having five. This particular recording features eight pennies. Red Nichols and Charlie Teagarden on trumpet, Glenn Miller and Charlie Butterfield trombone, Benny Goodman played clarinet, Bud Freeman tenor sax, Adrian Rollini baritone sax and xylophone, Joe Sullivan piano, Gene Krupa on drums. It's a fine recording with the Dixieland approach to Carolina in the Morning. Was the first contact that Glenn Miller had with a nationally famous band?
The Ben Pollock Band was the first one. Now, he was working in a theater out in Los Angeles, and Pollock and Gil Roden went down to hear him play, and as Gil told me later on, he said, we really had no way of telling how good he was because the band was so bad. It was just a pit band playing in a theater. Mm-hmm. You couldn't tell much. But they invited him to come over and rehearse with the band, and Glenn was interested in playing with him, of course, as anybody would be, because the Pollock Band was the band among musicians in those days. But he was even more interested in writing for the band. And so they hired him, and he stayed with the band until one night Gil Roden, who was so instrumental in the band, heard Jack Teagarden play. And he told me, I just knew we had to have Jack in the band, and he figured that they could have two trombone players in the band instead of just one. But Glenn got the message. He knew how great Jack was, and he decided that he'd stay in New York and work with Paul Ashe's band at the Paramount Theater, which was a pit band in those days,
Paul Ashe.
Uh-huh. And that's when he left Ben Pollock.
George, a moment ago we played a 1930 recording that Glenn had made with Red Nichols and the orchestra. During 1931, if we can jump ahead musically, he continued to record with Nichols. Now I'll quote from your book. He also cut a total of 18 sides for Benny Goodman, including the now famous rendition of Basin Street Blues by the Charleston Chasers, one of Benny's numerous recording units. Then in parenthesis, various jazz men, using various names, would assemble various jazz groups for various record companies. In addition to the arrangement, Glenn also contributed an original verse that began, "Won't you come along with me down the Mississippi," which has since become as famous as the song itself. The side focused on Jack Teagarden's trombone and voice, and more than any other recording, helped to establish him as a major jazz star. This recording features Ruby Weinstein and Charlie Teagarden on trumpets, Glenn Miller and Jack Teagarden on trombones, Sid Stoneburn and Larry Binion saxes, Artie Schutt piano, Dick McDonough guitar, Harry Goodman bass, Gene Krupa on drums. It dates from 1931, and it features, of course, Jack Teagarden.
Won't you come along with me to the Mississippi? We'll take the boat to the land of dreams, steam down the river, down to New Orleans. A band there to meet us, old friends to greet us, where all the dark and the light folks meet. This is Basin Street. Basin Street is a street where dark and light always meet in New Orleans, land of dreams. You'll never know how nice it seems or just how much it really means. Glad to be, yes, sirree, where welcome free, dear to me, where I can lose my Basin Street blues.
Certainly a classic recording from 1931. And despite the fact that Glenn Miller played next to this great Jack Teagarden, Jack Teagarden never became his favorite trombonist.
No, it's funny. The first time I ever met Glenn, I asked him who his favorite trombone player was. At that time, Glenn was playing in the Ray Noble Band. And I thought he would say Jack Teagarden or Tommy Dorsey or Jack Jenny, who was my favorite at that time. He said, no. He said, the greatest trombone player I know is a fellow named Wilbur Schwitzenberg, who's playing with me in the Ray Noble Band. Well, Wilbur Schwitzenberg was his favorite because he said he could do more things better than any trombone player I know. And later on, because he obviously could never get the name Wilbur Schwitzenberg on any marquee, Wilbur Schwitzenberg changed his name to Will Bradley.
And he's a pretty good musician, too,
great,
indeed.
Yes.
Our guest is George T. Simon. You're listening to A One-Night Stand with the Big Bands. This is your host, Arnold Dane, and you are tuned to the Sound of Service for Southern New England, WTIC, in Hartford, Connecticut. Tonight's program is being brought to you by WTIC and by Russo Chevrolet. These days, it's almost impossible to give your car all the care it needs to stay in top condition without professional help. That's why it's important to buy from a dealer who feels service is equally as important as sales. When you purchase a car from Russo Chevrolet in Windsor Locks, you've found a dealer you can rely on. Russo is a full-service Chevrolet dealer. Their experienced service staff is ready to handle any problem your car presents them with. With the aid of an electronic engine analyzer, a highly sensitive testing device, they can detect any malfunction in your engine and correct it promptly and accurately. If for any reason your car should require body or upholstery work, Russo Chevrolet offers you the services of one of the finest body and upholstery shops in the area. So for quality cars and dependable service, visit Russo Chevrolet, just a short drive from Hartford. Take the Bradley exit from I-91, then the first exit to Russo, R-U-S-S-O, Russo Chevrolet, across from the Bradley Air Museum in Windsor Locks. George, let's talk again about the Ray Noble Band. It was a band that really had some great personnel, and as I understand it, Glenn Miller had a great deal to do with the recruiting the personnel for that Noble Band.
What happened there, Arnold, is that Ray Noble had a great band over in England. Actually, it was never an organized band. It was a band, a recording band, made up of top musicians from various other bands, which went into the HMV, His Master's Voice Studio, and recorded many great sides. And when the sides started coming over here, the music started coming over here, Rockwell O'Keefe, which is an upcoming band agency, decided to book Noble. Well, they found out, first of all, that he had no set band, and secondly, that he couldn't bring him over anyway because of union restrictions, which wouldn't allow foreign musicians to compete with our musicians. So they got Glenn Miller, who had previously organized the Dorsey Brothers Band, to organize this band for Ray Noble. And so when Ray Noble got here, the band was pretty well assembled. And in the band, in addition to Glenn, in addition to Will Bradley on trombones, were Charlie Spivak and Pee Wee Irwin on trumpets, and Claude Thornhill on piano,
wow,
and Bud Freeman on tenor sax,
ooh,
and Johnny Mintz on clarinet. And there was quite a band. George Van Epps also was guitarist.
Sounds like an all-star aggregation.
Fantastic band, yeah. And it was very funny. It was a band with really two styles. It had Ray Noble's Pretty Things, which featured the wonderful vocals of Al Boley,
mm-hmm,
and then it also had the jazz things, which Glenn arranged for them, things like Way Down Yonder in New Orleans.
Thank you.
Now, we mentioned that Glenn Miller played with the Ray Noble Band and the Ben Pollock Band. What other famous bands? Was he with the Dorsey Brothers?
Oh, he practically organized the Dorsey Brothers Band, too. He put together quite a few of the people in the band. What happened is that when Glenn was with Smith Ballou's band out in Denver, Colorado, it was just about to break up, and Glenn didn't realize at the time they were about to break up, and he heard quite a few good young musicians out there, Skeets Herford, Don Madison, Rock Hillman, a girl singer named Kay Weber, and he got them all to come to New York ostensibly to work with Ballou's band, but the booking that they had for the Ballou band fell through. So Glenn was very kind to these people. When I spoke to him, they said he was wonderful to them. He felt very guilty for having him brought to New York, and he took them all around and introduced them to various people. And then when the Dorsey Brothers decided to form their band, Glenn was very close to them anyway, they got together with Glenn. They really never got started on the idea until Glenn sort of cemented the whole thing for them. And Glenn got some other people like Ray McKinley on drums, who had been with Smith Ballou's band, and Delmar Kaplan, a wonderful bass player, and a few other people. And he did quite a few of the arrangements for the band also.
So when did the bug bite Glenn Miller? And when did he decide that he wanted to go off and form his own band? This been in the back of his mind all the time?
I don't think so. I think it only started when he saw that other people like Benny Goodman and Tommy Dorsey and Artie Shaw and Jimmy Dorsey and people Bunny Berrigan he had known and had worked with were doing so well with bands. Glenn was a very commercial man. He wanted to go after the money. He was great businessman.
Was it for artistic reasons that he wanted his own band or financial?
I think both. He was very strong-headed, very opinionated, and I know he wanted to do things his way and didn't like, and you know, he had had a lot of trouble with Ray Noble, and he had left Ray Noble under not very happy circumstances. Oh. And I think he said, well, the only way to do it really was to do it on his own. And when he saw that the others could make a success of it, I think he decided to do it. I first knew about it late in 1936, when he cornered me one night and said, look, you're with Metronome magazine, and you get around to hear a lot of musicians. How about finding some young musicians for me, because I want to start a band, and I'd like you to help me start the band. Of course, I loved the idea, because by that time I'd gotten to know Glenn, and I was crazy about him as a person, and I could see that he was a doer, a man who really did things. So, matter of fact, in March of 1937, I went out on the limb in Metronome magazine. I ran a copy of that quote in here, which I went out and said that on a big limb and said that this would probably be the country's number one band. And I was very wrong for a couple of years, as you know. The band did terribly badly.
Yeah, The Band That Failed is what it's called in part two of your book, Glenn Miller and His Orchestra. What was wrong with the band? Why did it fail?
I think it failed basically because it had no really identifiable sound. It wasn't until he got the sound with the lead clarinet that he started to get what he wanted. Also, he had a lot of musicians who gave him a lot of trouble. He had some guys who drank much too much, and the band, he never knew exactly what was going to happen any one night. He also had a lot of personal troubles. His wife got terribly ill, had a very major operation, and everything went wrong for him. It was just, poor guy, he must have gone through hell.
Was that in 1937?
Yeah, that was towards the end of 1937. He knew he just couldn't make it anymore. He lost about $18,000 of his own money, which is a lot of money in those days. It's interesting, in doing all the research for this book, I was privileged to go down to the Glenn Miller vaults. David McKay, who is now the lawyer for the estate, gave me a key to the Walt said, help yourself, you know, and put a copying machine down there. And I went through his income tax things. There's a copy of a check in the book here for his income tax, I think, for the year 1932. And his total income tax for that year was $4.39.
Yeah. How things were to change.
Yeah.
I have a recording here, George, called Anytime, Any Day, Anywhere.
Oh, my God, yeah. I know that one.
Is that the band that failed?
That's the band that failed, and one reason it failed is because of the drummer in the band.
Oh.
Yeah.
Fellow we happen to know by any chance.
Yeah, fellow is looking at you. It's very funny. this book, this hit me just a little while ago. The subtitle of this book is America's Most Unforgettable Band Leader. And I think the drummer on this recording could be listed as America's most forgettable drummer.
Well, he was always a good recruiter of talent, so he must have liked your drumming.
I think he was playing a little politics, too. I wouldn't be surprised, because I was a writer in those days as well, and I don't think it would hurt any to have me on hand.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I wasn't that bad as I listened. As I listen to it now, there's a majestic 1 1/4 bar drum break, or maybe it's 3/4 bar drum break right after the trumpet solo that will go down in history as one of the least auspicious things ever to happen on records.
Let's listen to it anytime, any day, anywhere by Glenn Miller and the orchestra. I can't say featuring, but with George T. Simon on drums. There you have it, George. That's quite a recording of the band that failed.
It didn't sound too much like the current band at all.
No,
rather,
no.
Rather, not the current band, but the band that made it, which is the next section in the book.
Who was in that recording that we should know about?
Well, the trumpets were Charlie Spivak and Manny Klein and Sterling Bowles, who sang on the thing.
Yeah.
And along with a group called the Tune Twisters, of which Jack Lathrop, who was later the guitar player in the band,
sure,
was a member of the Tune Twisters. And the saxes were led by Hal McIntyre, who's from around here,
yeah,
you know, who was from around here. George Serafo was the other alto.
Oh,
Jerry Jerome and Carl Biesecker were the tenor sax players. Jesse Ralph and Harry Rogers were the trombone players. Howard Smith of Tommy Dorsey's band was piano player.
Yes.
Dick McDonough was on guitar. And a fellow named Ted Katsafatis was on bass.
Well, you did an excellent job in recruiting talent then, there's no question.
Oh, no, Glenn recruited most of these. Not all of them. Jerry Jerome, I got George Serafo, I got McIntyre, we got together. Of course, Spivak and Manny Klein and Sterling Bowles were all friends of his.
Of course, Spivak and Hal McIntyre both came from the state of Connecticut. I guess McIntyre was about the first person hired for that band.
He was the first person,
number
yes,
one.
Mm-hmm.
As the lead alto man?
As lead alto, yeah.
Yeah.
He was there before anybody. He was there, and then he left, I guess it was around August, as I recall, of 1942, to start his own band with Glenn's blessings. In fact, mm-hmm, Glenn backed him. Benny Goodman was driving through this area, and he heard a band from a New Britain radio station, and playing his arrangements for the clarinet player sounded pretty good to him.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted to find out who it was. And so he found out who it was, and he called up Hal at home and said, "This is Hal McIntyre, and Hal a worship? And he said, yeah. I said, well, this is Benny Goodman calling. And Hal's hung up, you know. Thought it was a gag. So Glenn had to get his secretary to call Hal back to explain that it was really Benny calling.
We talk about the band that failed, George. Then he decided to disband, which I suppose is the most apt term to use.
Yes.
This was late in 1937?
No, 38. He started the band. The first recordings were made in March of 1937, and the first date the band ever played was at the Hotel New Yorker in May of 1937.
Mm-hmm.
And then for a while things were very good. The band went to New Orleans and played at the Hotel Roosevelt down there. Broke all records for longevity. They stayed there for 10 weeks and were very popular down there. But then they went to Dallas and laid an egg, went to Minneapolis and laid another egg, went up to Boston and played the Raymore Ballroom, didn't do very well up there. And generally things were just not good at all. And as I said earlier, Glenn was having so many personal problems, and the band had no identifiable sound. He didn't quite know where he was going. And so on January 2nd, 1938, he chucked it all.
Then, what did he do after he chucked the band? Did he go play with somebody else? Did he arrange for someone?
He did some arranging for Benny Goodman. I remember Raleigh Bunduck, the bass player who's from around this area, uh-huh. told me that he used to do the copying for Glenn, copying of arrangements, which means taking them from the score and making individual parts. And he told me that he remembers that Glenn did one arrangement of One Morning in May, and Benny Goodman returned it and said it's too ornate to him.
Oh,
yeah,
is that right?
Yeah. But he also did some playing in the studios. He played with Tommy Dorsey's band, just on the Raleigh cigarette commercial show that Tommy used to have. He didn't play with it in his personal appearances, but Tommy used him to bolster the trombone section.
Then he decided to reorganize his band?
Yeah, he got some more backing first from his parents-in-law, Helen's folks, who took a second mortgage on their home, and then later on from Cy Shripman.
I thought Cy Shripman entered the picture here. I guess that anything that Glenn Miller achieved, he always credited Cy Shripman with having started it all.
Cy was a magnificent man. He was a man up in Boston who booked bands, but who also owned ballrooms. So that if you wanted to start a band, or help finance a band, as he did with several, with Artie Shaw, with Woody Herman, with Glenn, with Tony Pasta, he had it all made because he could book them right into his own ballroom and give them at least two or three nights a week work. And then he booked them into colleges and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But the band, for a long time, didn't make much money. The whole band made maybe... Well, I remember one night in Boldrin, Maine, they got $150 for the whole night, the band. You know, it was ridiculous. But then along came Glen Allen Casino, Frank Daly's Meadowbrook, and places like that where the band had some airtime. And all of a sudden...
Broadcast did it.
Now here's the whole gang with a barbecue job on the Boogly Woogly Piggy.
Take it from me, I've just found something to see. Oh, it's a pig, it does the boogie, yes sirree, and he really gets to do it solidly.
You mean he really gets to do it solidly? This little piggy went to market. This little piggy
made
home.
But this little piggy was a boogly woogly piggy, and he boogie woogied all the way home.
This little piggy had horse beef. This little piggy had none.
But this little piggy was a boogly woogly piggy, and he
did the lindy all the way home. Oink, oink.
Piggly wiggy piggy.
Oink, oink.
Boogly woogie boogie.
Oink, 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 oink.
The boogly woogly piggly with the oink, oink.
This little piggy dug to be. This piggy thought the waltz was divine.
But this little piggy was a hip little piggy, and he
boogie woogied all of the time.
piggy was a hip little piggy, and he boogie-woogied all of the time.
How did he come upon that magic sound in the reed section?
That came about when he was with Ray Noble's band. He was arranging for Ray Noble's band. Ray Noble had a trumpet player named Pee Wee Irwin, you probably remember, yeah. who loved to play high notes. And so Glenn used to write some arrangements in which Pee Wee would play the lead, and Glenn experimented by having the saxes play the harmony part, three saxes underneath Pee Wee, with a fourth sax, the tenor sax, doubling the lead.
Mm-hmm.
Then when Pee Wee left the band and Sterling Bowes came in, Sterling had no lip like Pee Wee. He couldn't play those high parts. So Glenn still had some of the arrangements to do. So he, in the book, so he decided one time as an experiment to let Johnny Mintz, the clarinet player, play the trumpet part. The two instruments are on the same register, a B-flat register. And then he got one of the fiddle players in the band, a fellow named Danny Dandrea, who could double on sax, to play another sax part. So then he had one clarinet and four saxes instead of one trumpet and four saxes.
Mm-hmm.
And the sound was intriguing to him. Noble apparently never liked it very much, and Glenn forgot about it, because when he had his first band, the band that failed, he never used it at all, except maybe for a bar or two here. And then later on, when he had time to think, well, I've got to do something, I've got to find an identifiable sound if I'm ever going to make it with this next band, he thought about that and decided to make that his sound.
Thank you.
What did Glenn Miller look like? We've all seen pictures, but as you describe him, I didn't realize he played football, for example. He's a bigger man than I thought.
He's about 6 feet. Yeah, about 6 feet and weighed about 180 pounds. He played football in high school.
And pretty well, I understand.
Yeah, I understand he was an all-star end, all-state end in high school. But he never played much after that. When he went to college, he wasn't in college very long. He was only there altogether for three quarters of a year.
How were his grades?
Interesting. Because
so were mine.
He had very high grades in math, but when it came to harmony, he got a 50. He flunked harmony. Yeah. And it's very interesting that he was there for two semesters the freshman year, and then came back for his third semester, which there were quarter semesters there. For the third quarter, he took at the beginning of what would have been a sophomore year, except it wasn't a sophomore year, it was just the following year. And he failed three out of five courses there. He was so much interested in music. Mm-hmm. He was playing with bands around there, and he devoted very little time to college and finally decided to drop out.
So now we're up to part three of your book, George, The Band That Made It. And there are so many questions to ask about that band and about the personnel in it. In the first place, I'm curious to know, what did he consider his biggest hit? Was it In the Mood, or did that come a little bit later?
Well, the first million record seller that RCA Victor had ever since 1924, I think it was, when Gene Austin had a record of My Blue Heaven, was Chattanooga Choo Choo.
Mm-hmm.
I think now, in retrospect, I think the biggest hit he ever had was In the Mood, though, because that brings out more oohs and ahs.
Whenever, yeah, it still does.
Yeah, whenever Glenn Miller music is played.
Thank you. that fabulous original recording by the Glenn Miller Band of In the Mood. There's no better time to appreciate the beauty of the great outdoors than the summertime. And there's no better way to see the beautiful country than behind the wheel of a 1974 Chevy Blazer, featured now at Russo Chevrolet in Windsor Locks. The Blazer is one of the newest models in Chevy's lineup. It was designed for toughness, built as if there were no roads at all. Featured on every Chevy Blazer are a frame made of high-strength carbon steel, a reinforced hood, double-wall front fenders, and an energy-absorbing steering column. A new power brake system matching stopping power to total vehicle weight has been incorporated into each and every Blazer. Options on the Blazer include a comfort tilt steering wheel, air conditioning, and an AM or AM/FM radio. See and test drive a new Chevy Blazer at Russo Chevrolet in Windsor Locks. Take the Bradley exit from I-91, then the first exit to Russo Chevrolet, directly across from the Bradley Air Museum, just a short drive from Hartford. When it comes to Chevrolet, the people at Russo are experts. There's so much more to say and so much more great music to play by Glenn Miller and the orchestra that we're going to invite George T. Simon back for part two in this series with Glenn Miller and his orchestra on next month's One Night Stand. Thanks to our special guest, and a reminder that we will be back in just a month on Thursday night, August 8th, between 9:05 and 10 p.m., and we'll again interview George T. Simon, and we'll concentrate on some of the music, some of it never heard before on WTIC Radio by that fabulous Glenn Miller AAF Band. This program was recorded and edited by Bob Schirrego, and this is Arnold Dane. A one-night stand has been brought to you by WTIC and by Russo Chevrolet across from the Bradley Air Museum in Windsor Locks, where both sales and service are outstanding.